leaned back a little and looked me over as if she might buy me.
"You're not fat at all," she said. "How'd you get so big?"
"Practice," I said. She reached over and squeezed my bicep.
"Ooh," she said.
"Ooh?
You must be very strong."
We drank again, which took care of Bibi's gimlet. I nodded to the bartender, and he brought her another one.
"Are you in town alone?" she said.
"Yes."
"Is that because you are alone?"
"You mean, do I have a person?"
"Yes."
"I do," I said.
"What's her name?"
"Susan," I said.
"You married?"
"Not exactly."
"Not exactly? What does that mean?"
"It means not exactly," I said. Bibi tasted her new gimlet. Quite a lot of it.
"Leaves you room to maneuver," she said.
I saw no reason to explain Susan and me to Bibi, so I nodded.
"She pretty?"
"No," I said. "She's beautiful."
"Well, aren't you gallant?"
She put the stress on the last syllable. "I'm accurate." I stressed the last syllable, too.
"Is she as beautiful and as sweet as Lou Buckman?" Bibi said.
"Do I hear irony in your voice?" I said.
"Of course not," Bibi said.
She finished her second gimlet in another big swallow. I nodded at the bartender.
"Lou is very beautiful and very sweet."
She looked at her empty glass and looked up at the bartender. She saw that he was putting the finishing touches on her next gimlet and looked relieved. "As sweet as you," I said. Bibi grinned. She was already a little sloshed.
"Almost," she said.
The bartender put her third gimlet on a napkin in front of her. She picked it up promptly and drank some. "And how sweet are you?" I said.
"Maybe you'll find out," she said.
"Okay. So how sweet is Lou?" Bibi giggled.
"Maybe you'll find that out, too. You wouldn't be the first."
"I thought she was blissful in her marriage," I said.
"Sometimes."
Bibi had a little gimlet. "Tell me about it," I said. She looked at my half glass of beer.
"You're not staying up with me," she said.
"I started before you," I said.
"You don't like to get drunk," she said.
"I find it hampers me when I do." She giggled.
"Wouldn't want you hampered," she said,
and bumped her knee against mine. I tried to look seductive. "Tell me about Lou and Steve."
"Them," she said.
I nodded encouragingly.
"Well, I know at least two men she had flings with. I assume they weren't the only two."
"I'll be damned," I said. "Who were they?" Bibi slugged in some gimlet.
"Who?"
"The men she had flings with," I said. "Spencer, you old gossip."
"Well, Mark for one, and dear old Dino for another."
"Mark Ratliff?"
"Uh-huh."
"And the cop?"
"Dean Walker," she said.
"And how do you know this?" I said. Bibi smiled as serenely as she could, being fairly well bagged.
"Men like to kiss and tell," she said.
She might have said, "Kish." "These guys just stopped by the office one day and told," I said.
"Not exactly," she said.
"Am I to gather that you were flinging a little yourself?" I said. She giggled and drank.
"I like to kish and tell myself."
"Don't we all?" I said. She finished her gimlet.
"You got a room?" she said.
"Sure do," I said.
"Let's go see it," she said.
"Let's," I said. I was trying to leer, but she was too drunk to notice. I signed the tab and took her arm, and we went out of the bar and into the lobby and up the stairway to my room. Inside, she looked around the room.
"So neat," she said. "Why don't you have room service bring us up a drink? I gotta freshen up a little."
"You bet." She was in the bathroom for a long time, When she came out, I could see that she had worked on her hair a little, and there was a fresh smell of newly sprayed perfume.
"Room service come yet?"
"Not yet," I said.
"Well, maybe we should lie on the bed and wait for them," she said.
"That would be swell," I said. She walked over to the bed and lay down on it. She smiled at me and patted the bed beside her.
"Come on," she said. "I won't bite."
I sat on the edge of the bed next to her. "So tell me a little about Steve Buckman," I said. She stared up at me. Her eyes were unfocused. Her pupils looked very big.
"Steve?"
"Yes. What was he really like?" She kept looking at me.
"Come on," she said. "Let's do it now."
"You think Steve was different than he seemed?" I said. Her eyelids drooped. I thought she might be trying to look vampish. Then her eyelids shut. I was saved. She was asleep. I straightened her out a little, put the spread over her, canceled the room service, and left. Chapter 9. When I came back into the bartender gave me a look full of questions he knew he shouldn't ask. "Beer," I said.
"Will there be a gimlet with that, sir?"
"Couldn't resist, could you?" I said. He shrugged.
"There's always other jobs," he said.
"Mrs. Taylor is resting," I said. The bartender smiled. "She started resting as soon as we got upstairs," I said.
"Never heard it call that," the bartender said.
"Beer," I said. He brought it and moved back down the bar, smiling to himself. I sipped a little beer. I missed Susan. I was spending too much time alone in my head. Solitary speculation is good up to a point. Your mind is uncluttered, you can focus, but with no one to test your perceptions against, things eventually began to circle on themselves. I had spent a lot of time during my life inside my own head. Since I'd been with Susan, I had her to help me think, and even when I was away from her, I could sometimes clear my head by explaining things to her in absentia. It was clear that Bibi was restive in her marriage.
Indeed.
Everything else is less clear. If I believed what she told me, then things are not quite what they had seemed. This was not surprising. Almost nothing is quite what it seems. Even the preacher is a little different than I'd expected.
Of course.
Unless both Bibi and Ratliff are lying, it's pretty sure that Lou Buckman knows Mark Ratliff well and omitted him from her list. She could have forgotten, though it seems unlikely, especially if she'd slept with him. She could be ashamed of sleeping with him and omitted him in hopes it wouldn't come up. And if she had been sleeping with Dean Walker, it's reasonable that neither would mention it. But it would suggest that Lou also was restive in her marriage.
Cherchez la femme?
Susan, too? Lou being restive in her marriage doesn't mean she killed him. Why would she hire me to find out who killed him if she was the one? Why would she hire me to find out who killed him if she didn't love him enough to be faithful? My imagination shrugged. Maybe she loved him in her fashion, and her fashion was different from the ones I endorsed. Susan shook her head.
You don't cheat on someone you love?
No.
Ratliff was from L.A. Lou and Steve Buckman were from L.A. I wonder where Walker's from. Nobody's from Potshot. Except maybe somebody from the Dell. I've got plenty of time to think about it. Bibi didn't look like she was going to wake up soon, and when she does, I don't want to be in the room. Bibi is a single-minded woman.
Yes.
I drank a little more beer, carefully. In a town where I had annoyed nearly everyone, including the leader of a large gang of vicious thugs, I thought it unwise to get rolling drunk. Maybe I should confront Lou with the allegations. What does that get me? She'll deny them, and I still won't know whether they're true.
Uh-huh.
And if she's conning me, then I've given away that I know it, and my chances of figuring out the con are reduced.
Uh-huh.
So maybe pretty soon I should go to L.A. and look into these people a little, and maybe Susan should come with me.
Maybe.
And in the meantime, I got nothing else to do except sit around and see what develops. What if I went up and lay down on the bed with Bibi for a while?
Maybe not.
Chapter 10. It was too soon to go back to my room. Bibi would still be there asleep. I wondered if she'd remember anything when she woke up. Maybe she'd think we had in fact done the deed and would look on me fondly next time we met. I went out and sat in a straight chair on the front porch of the Jackrabbit Inn, with one foot against a post, balancing my chair on its back legs, feeling like Henry Fonda in My Darling Clementine. I was alone. A cheery male weather weenie on television had said that the temperature was 108. People in shorts and sunglasses glanced at me in puzzlement as they moved quickly in and out of air-conditioned stores. A lot of them wore big hats. The pot-shot police cruiser with two of Dean Walker's four cops in it was idling in front of the hotel. An old International Harvester scout with no top came noisily down Main Street past me and rolled to a stop in front of the store where Lou Buckman ran her excursion business. The preacher was sitting in the front seat next to the driver. The patrol car slipped into gear and moved away. There were two guys in the back seat of the scout. If any of them noticed me sitting on the porch like Wyatt Earp, they didn't show it. What's the point of sitting like Wyatt Earp in 108-degree heat if no one pays any attention? When the car stopped, one of the guys in the back, a tall guy with shoulder-length hair who looked sort of like Ichabod Crane, swung a leg over the side and jumped out as agilely as if he didn't look like Ichabod. He went into Lou Buckman's store and came out in a short time holding Lou by the arm. I let my chair fall forward and stood and walked toward them. We all reached the topless scout at the same time. The preacher saw me coming and watched me, I think, through black sunglasses until I reached the car.
"Spencer," he said.
"Preacher."
"Mrs. Buckman been making contributions to the Dell," he said.
I could barely hear him. The tall guy let go of Lou Buckman and shifted his ground a little. The second rider was sitting with one foot on the console between the front seats. He was wearing motorcycle boots, and a knife was stuck in the top of the left one, which would make him left-handed. He wasn't as tall as I am, but he was wider, an obvious bodybuilder, wearing a sweaty-looking orange T-shirt with the sleeves cut off. His head was shaved. He had prison tattoos on both forearms. The driver was Mexican, clean-shaven and smooth-looking. They both appeared bored with the whole scene. "And she's delinquent?" I said.
"Delinquent," the preacher said.
He did his soft little snarly laugh.
"That's what she is," he said. "She's fucking delinquent."
"And this is small claims court," I said. The preacher looked at the men with him.
"Small claims court," he murmured. "That's a good one, isn't it?"
The other men nodded. I looked at Lou Buckman. "You want to pay them the money, Lou?" "I want these men to leave me alone," she said. I nodded.
"Want to got nothing to do with it," the preacher said.
I nodded again. Taciturn. Everybody was quiet.
"You're going to interfere," the preacher mumbled. "Ain't you?"
"Yep." The preacher jerked his head at Ichabod, and Ichabod kicked me in the hip. He would have kicked me in the groin had I not moved my groin out of the way. It made me stagger back a couple of steps, and Ichabod jumped in swinging. He was strong the way some of those tall, bony guys are strong, and he was pretty good. He put out a nice stiff left, which he planned to follow with a right cross. I slipped to the left, which threw him off enough so that I could step inside the right cross and get a handful of his hair. I pulled his head forward and broke his nose with my head. Still holding his hair in one hand, I got my other hand into his crotch and put my shoulder into him and lifted him off the ground and slammed him down on the hood of the truck. He grunted and went limp. When I stood back, he slowly slid off the hood and lay in the street with his mouth open. I turned to meet the bodybuilder who had scrambled out of the back seat. He had the knife out of his boot top, holding it low in his left hand. He was stronger than Ichabod, and he had a knife. I moved away from him. The preacher was watching with no expression. The Mexican still looked bored. He started toward me. I had my gun in an ankle holster, but I didn't want to start shooting in the middle of the street if I didn't have to. I took another step back and slid my belt out of my pant loops. It was a wide leather belt with a big buckle. I had a momentary vision of my pants falling down and me winning the fight when everyone fell down laughing. I looped it around my left hand so that the buckle end swung loose. Almost gently, the bodybuilder made a pass at me with a knife. It was big, like a Bowie knife. I hit him in the wrist, just above the knife, with the belt buckle, and he made kind of a yelp. I swung the belt buckle backhand and hit him in the face with it. He yelped again, and put his right hand up to shield himself, and lunged at me with the knife. I jumped back. He came up short. He lunged again, and I kicked him in the groin. He was not as alert as I had been. He didn't move his groin behind his hip. He howled this time and doubled over. I grabbed the knife arm and pulled it toward me, and stepped under it and twisted it up behind his back. I gave his shoulder a wrench, and the knife fell from his hand and landed dully on the soft asphalt. I shoved him away from me, and he staggered and stood bent over with his hands between his thighs next to Ichabod. I spun away from him, moving to my right, looking for the Mexican. He was still sitting, still bored, except that he was pointing a big revolver with a long barrel at me. I stopped. I didn't see Lou. The preacher was watching me the way you might watch an unusual lizard. On the sidewalks on both sides of the street, people had stopped to stare. They stood in little groupings, some of them sheltering behind whatever they could shelter behind, in case things got to flying around. There were faces in the store windows, and down the street I could see Lou walking toward us with Dean Walker.
"Shoot him," the Mexican said.
The preacher was silent for a moment.
"Let me think," he said.
Walker left Lou Buckman on the sidewalk and stepped into the street.
"You're under arrest," he said to me.
The preacher said,
"Walker?"
"I assume these gentlemen wish to press charges," Walker said.
The Mexican rested the long-barreled handgun in his lap, still pointed at me. The preacher looked at Walker and me. On the street, Ichabod was sitting up, and the bodybuilder had gotten to his knees. The Mexican looked at the preacher. The preacher said something I couldn't hear and gestured forward with his chin. The Mexican put the gun down, put the truck in gear, and drove away. Chapter 11 I sat in Dean Palmer's cool office with him and Lou Buckman.
"Well," Palmer said, "we've given them enough time. I guess they're not going to pursue assault charges."
I said, "Whew."
"So I guess I can't hold you."
"I don't know why you arrested him anyway," Lou said. "He was just trying to protect me." Walker nodded.
"That's sort of my job," he said.
"Well, isn't it your job to arrest that preacher?"
"For what?"
"For having Steve killed."
"I got no evidence, Lou."
"Because you're afraid to look for it."
"Or because there isn't any."
"You didn't seem so worried about that when you arrested a man who wasn't doing anything wrong."
"Lou," I said, "he arrested me to keep me from getting shot by the preacher's driver."
She sat for a moment without doing anything. Then she opened her mouth and closed it again without saying anything.
"That's Spencer's theory," Walker said.
Lou stood up suddenly and stalked from the office. Walker watched her go. She would have slammed the door, except that it was on a pneumatic closer, and she couldn't. When she was gone and the door had closed, Walker and I looked at each other. Neither of us spoke for a time. Then Walker said,
"You're free to go."
So I went. I pushed through the heat, back up Main Street, toward my hotel. Chapter 12 The day after I had my first fight with Adele, I came into the lobby of the Jackrabbit Inn, and J. George Taylor was standing near the front desk, talking with the bell captain. J. George was one of those guys that would bend whatever ear was closest. J. George spotted me as soon as I entered. I wondered if he was going to challenge me to a duel.
"Spencer, can I buy you a drink?"
Apparently not. "Sure," I said. He clapped the bell captain on the shoulder and led me into the bar. The bartender nodded at me without expression as we went by. In a booth on the back wall of the bar was a round table. Three men were sitting with drinks and a basket of tortilla chips. J. George introduced me as though I were meeting the leaders of the free world.
"This is Roscoe Land, our esteemed mayor. This is Luther Barnes, who serves as city attorney, and this is Henry Brown, who ramrods the Foothills Bank and Trust."
I shook hands all around and sat. The cocktail waitress appeared. She was dressed like Dale Evans.
"What are you drinking?" the mayor said to me.
He was a tall, flabby guy with rimless glasses and a gray crew cut that wasn't cut short enough. "Beer," I said.
"Beer, Margie, and, he made a circular gesture at the table, "and hit the rest of us one more time."
Margie cantered away.
"I gotta tell you," the mayor said, "we liked what you did out there."
"We having a victory celebration?" I said.
"Well," the mayor laughed, though not like he meant it, "you might say so. You are one tough cookie."
"That would be me," I said. Margie came back with drinks and set them out. While she was at the table, nobody spoke. When she left, the mayor looked after her.
He said, "That little girl's got a hell of a butt, doesn't she?"
I heard Luther Barnes inhale as though his patience was being tried. He was a young-looking guy with gray hair and thick eyebrows. His face was one of those pale English ancestry faces which would never tan. The closest he had gotten was a mild sunburn.
"Could we get to it, Roscoe?" he said.
Very businesslike, he'd been to law school, and he wasn't a man to waste time chit-chatting.
"Oh, throttle it back, Luther," the mayor said. "No reason not to talk a little before you make someone an offer."
Barnes nodded and tightened his mouth and looked at Henry Brown and rolled his eyes.
"The thing is," Brown said, "after what we've seen of you in action, we think you might be able to help us solve a problem."
I waited.
"This is an affluent town, and we have access to a considerable amount of money."
"Isn't that nice?" I said.
"It might be nice for you," Brown said. "You know who those people were that you tangled with today."
"I know the preacher," I said.
"So you know about the Dell?"
"Yes."
"Those men were from the Dell."
"I sort of intuited that," I said. "Years of training." Brown shifted gears a little.
"You're here looking into Steve Buckman's death."
I smiled helpfully.
"The prevailing theory is that he was killed by the Dell," Brown said, "because he refused to pay them off."
"I've heard that," I said.
"The Dell is a cancer on this town."
"I've heard that, too."
"They intimidate our police. They extort money from our businesses. They frighten the citizens. They come in here, everywhere, and run up a bill and leave without paying. Their presence is destroying our businesses, which depend largely on people coming here for the desert air. Our real estate values are non-existent.
We have complained to the police. They are either afraid or corrupt, I would guess both. In any case, they do nothing. The sheriff's department has sent investigators, but witnesses are intimidated, and no one can make a case. And frankly, I'm not sure we are the sheriff's top priority. Many natives look at us as a bunch of yuppie intruders."
"Incredible," I said.
"You're not too talkative, are you?" Luther Barnes said.
"I'm a good listener," I said, "and a very good dancer, too."
Barnes frowned.
"Well, when you do talk," he said, "must you be a wiseacre?"
"I fight it all the time," I said. "Was there something you wanted me to do for you?"
"We'd like you to rid us of the Dell," Barnes said.
"You mind if I freshen up a bit first?" I said.
"Damn it, this is serious," Barnes said.
"I'll say."
"We don't expect you to do it alone. We are prepared to provide funds for you to hire a band of mercenaries, as many as you need, to clean out the Dell."
"And we sneak in there some night and napalm the place," I said.
"You do whatever you must," Barnes said.
The rest of the group nodded. The mayor liked the sound of it.
"Whatever you must," the mayor said.
I sat back and looked at my hands resting on the tabletop. The left one was swollen. If I could get into my room without being sexually assaulted, I could ice it.
I might be able to help you, I said, but there are conditions.
We will not quibble with you over price, Barnes said.
Everyone nodded.
I'm sure you won't, but be clear about one thing. I am not an assassin. If I sign on for this, I can hire some people, and we can come out here and see what we can do. But it won't include murdering anybody.
Well, how? Brown said.
I don't know. My first priority is to find out who killed Steve Buckman. That would not seem to exclude your goal, but you are second on the list. And if we come, you don't get to change your mind in the middle of it and call everything off. None of them seemed quite sure what to say about that.
What would it take to make us number one on your list? Barnes said.
Nothing.
If it's a matter of money, Brown said.
It's not.
Well, the mayor said, you'd consult with us.
Maybe, I said.
You don't give much, do you? The mayor said.
Not much, I said.
Will you do it? Barnes said.
If the price is right, I said.
We'll make it right, Henry Brown said.
I looked at J. George, one of my oldest friends in Potshot, who had sat subserviently through the whole discussion without saying a word.
What do you think, George?
He smiled as if he just accidentally sold a house for cash.
It'll be great, he said. Just great.
Chapter 13 I went into my hotel room very carefully, but Bibi hadn't stayed. Maybe romance was dead. My hands were swollen from yesterday's fight. I iced them for a while. Then, in the early evening, I went back out to visit Lou Buckman. Buckman Outfitters was closed. There was a sign on the front door that read, I'm at the stable. The sign was correct. When I drove over there, she was in the corral, washing one of the horses with a hose. I got out of the rental car. Being tough as nails, I did not stagger when I hit the heat.
Hello, I said.
The horse's lead was tied to a fence post. He stood placidly, his dark brown coat gleaming while the water sluiced over him. When I spoke, he raised his head and looked at me with thoughtful dark eyes, and then let his head drop again.
Hi, Lou said.
I sat on the top rail of the fence. I didn't look right. I needed a big hat. I talked to the preacher, I said,
and punched out two of his men.
Before that, I said. I went up to the dell and talked with him.
To the dell?
Yep. Preacher says he didn't kill your husband.
Of course he didn't. He had it done.
Says he didn't have it done either, I said.
Well, of course he'd say that.
I think if he'd done it or had it done, he'd have let me know, I said.
Lou was scornful. Because he's so truthful?
Because he's so full of himself. He'd want me to know he could do whatever he pleased and get away with it.
You know him so well already?
I know people like him, I said. They'd be inclined to let me know they'd done it and challenge me to do anything about it.
Well, thank God I don't know anyone like that, and I don't believe it for a minute.
Steve stood up to them. First they threatened. Steve wouldn't back down, and they killed him.
We'll see, I said. Well, who the hell else would it be, she said.
I shrugged. Lou turned the chestnut horse loose and got another one, darker chestnut. She hooked the shank to the fence rail and sponged him down with soapy water from a bucket.
Have they frightened you off, she said, or paid you?
If they're paying me, I said, I just recently bit the hand that feeds me.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
I agree. She finished sponging the horse and began to rinse him with the hose.
It's just that everybody lets me down, she said. I keep hoping, and I keep being disappointed.
There was a bird song in the still heat. No whisper of wind. Only the sound of the water running, and now and then the exhausted buzz of an especially intrepid fly.
I spend too much time, she said, thinking about things.
The mayor and some people have hired me, too, I said.
To do what?
To sanitize the dell.
The dell? You mean run them out?
Something like that.
What about Steve?
If you're right, the tasks may be synergistic. She laughed, though not very warmly.
Synergistic, she said.
My God, you don't talk like someone who nearly killed two men this afternoon. Clean mind, sound body, I said. I'm going to leave for a while.
Leave?
Yes, you're running away. You're afraid that the preacher will get you for this afternoon. I'll be back, I said. You won't be back, she said. I don't even blame you. You can't face down the dell by yourself.
No, I said. I can't.
I'm going home to recruit some people. She shook her head.
I don't believe you, she said.
Nothing I can do about that, I said.
I won't pay you any more, she said. You earned what I've paid you this afternoon, but no more.
Sure, I said. While I'm gone, maybe you can count more on the potshot cops than you think you can.
About as much, she said, as I can count on you.
Chapter 14. It was morning, early. I was drinking coffee with the chief of the potshot police in an unmarked air-conditioned four-door black Ford Explorer parked outside the bank on Main Street. There was a rifle and a shotgun on the back seat. Between us, in the front seat, was the inevitable computer rig. When I started with the Middlesex DA's office, I said, there wasn't a cop in the country would have known what the hell that was.
Modern crime fighting, Walker said.
You've been a cop before, I said.
Yep.
Where?
Someplace else.
So why'd you end up here?
I like it here.
Sort of hot, I said.
At least you don't have to shovel it, he said.
Yeah, but it doesn't melt in the spring either.
You get used to it, Walker said.
You get used to it, I said. Walker shrugged and drank some coffee.
I hear that Roscoe and friends hired you, he said.
You got somebody undercover at the Rotary Club, I said.
Small town, Walker said. I heard they want you to clean up the dell.
I didn't say anything.
What about Steve Buckman?
I'm still working on that, I said.
Two jobs at once, he said. A real Boston rocket.
I shrugged modestly.
How you planning to go about that? Walker said.
If I were going to try and take out the preacher and his friends, why would I tell you?
Because you might need my help.
How much of that should I expect if you're in the preacher's pocket? Walker nodded. His khaki uniform shirt was pressed into sharp military creases. He wore big aviator glasses and a big walnut-handled Colt revolver and a tooled leather belt, complete with cartridge loops, each loop attractively set off by a big brass cartridge with a copper-coated tip.
"Me telling you I'm not ain't gonna convince you," he said.
"No, it ain't," I said.
"I do what I can," he said. "I've got four guys, kids, really, like the uniform and the chance to carry a piece. Preacher's got 40. None of them kids. I got to obey the law. Preacher can do what he wants. If I'm going to put him in jail, I need witnesses that will testify."
Frustrating, I said.
Walker shrugged.
Why not go someplace else?
Like I said, I like it here.
You going up against the dell alone?
Am I going to have trouble with you, I said.
Walker drank some more coffee and looked out through the tinted windshield at the heat shimmers rising from the asphalt.
"I don't want some kind of goddamn range war here," he said.
"Me either," I said. "Am I going to have trouble with you?"
"Not if you're legal," he said. "Maybe I'm not as crooked or scared as you think I am."
"You bought yourself a little credence yesterday," I said.
"Could have been phony," he said, "just trying to find out what you're up to."
"Could have been," I said. "I'm going out of town for a while, in case you want to keep an eye on Lou Buckman." He looked very sharply at me, but he didn't say anything. He simply nodded. I didn't say anything either. According to the time and temperature display outside the bank, it was 7:27 a.m. and 105 degrees. We finished our coffee in silence, and I got out of the car. I stood for a moment with the door open. There seemed to be something I should say, but I didn't know what it was. Neither did Walker. Finally, I said, "Good luck."
"You too," he said.
Chapter 15 It seemed the better part of valor not to take on the Dell by myself. And since I had smacked two Dellsters around in the public street, it seemed that if I stuck around, I might have to. I had my bag packed. I had said my goodbyes, such as they were, to Lou Buckman and Dean Walker. It seemed best not to say goodbye to B.B. Taylor. I had my gun unloaded and packed so I could check it through. If the Dell came for me now, I'd have to kick them to death. I checked out of the hotel, got in my rental car, turned up the air conditioning, and headed for the airport. For quite a while, I was on a two-lane highway, and everywhere I looked, there was only desert. A lot of the landscape was cactus and sage and scrub growth that looked brittle and sharp. It was a landscape in which no horse could gallop. It was a landscape through which a horse would pick his way, slowly, weaving in and out through the hostile vegetation. You just couldn't trust the movies. After my initial foray, I concluded that all in potshot was not as it seemed. There was something going on with Lou Buckman that I didn't get. There was a lot going on with Dean Walker I didn't get. And there was something about potshot that I didn't get. More annoying, I didn't even get what it was I didn't get. It was just the sense that in almost all my dealings with almost everyone I'd talked with, there was another story being told that I couldn't hear. I sort of trusted the preacher. He appeared to be a vicious thug, and I had no reason to think that he wasn't. It was nice to be able to count on somebody. I finally reached the interstate and turned on. Another hour to the airport and less than 5 hours home. There was something exultant about being alone on the highway under the high, hot, empty sky, 2,000 miles from anything familiar, heading straight for the horizon. And the fact that Susan was eventually beyond that horizon made the feeling tangible as it flickered along the nerve tracks. There were few words in the language better than going home. Home, of course, was Susan Silverman. It was good that she was in Boston, because I liked it there. But if she moved to Indianapolis, then that would be home. I could make a living. There was crime everywhere. Chapter 16 Susan and I had but recently engaged in some highly inventive Home from the Hills is the Hunter activity, and were now lying together on our backs on top of the covers while the sweat dried on our naked bodies. Pearl the Wonder Dog was curled up at the foot of the bed in a state of mild irritation that she wasn't able to weasel her way in between us. "So you turned tail and ran," Susan said. "I didn't know you were that sensible." "The grave's a fine and private place," I said, "but none, I think, do their embrace." "Do you mean that you didn't want to get killed?" Susan said. "Because if you did, you couldn't boff me?"
"Exactly," I said.
"Whatever your reason," Susan said, "I'm glad you're home."
"Me too."
"What are you going to do?"
"About potshot?"
"Uh-huh." Susan had her head on my shoulder. My arm was around her. "This is exactly the right moment," I said, "for me to light two cigarettes and hand one to you."
"Makes you regret not smoking for a moment," Susan said.
"Only for a moment," I said.
"So what's going to happen in potshot?"
"I'll go back out," I said. "Push some more."
"Because you said you would."
"Well, yeah, and because if I don't do what I say I'll do, in a little while I'll be out of business, because doing what I say I'll do is pretty much what I have to sell."
"I know."
"And I don't like to get chased away."
"I know."
"Of course," I said, "I could give it up and stand at stud."
"I wouldn't," Susan said.
"Just a thought," I said.
"Does Mary Lou Whatsis know you've left?"
"Yes."
"Does she know you're coming back?"
"I told her I would, but I'm not sure she believed me."
"The more fool she," Susan said. "Should we get up and prepare a post-coital supper?"
At the foot of the bed, Pearl raised her head and looked at us. "Which word do you think she understands?" I said. "Post-coital or supper?"
"She understands everything," Susan said.
"Well, she can join us," I said. "Are you ready?"
"Yes."
Neither of us moved.
"Are we going to leap up?" I said.
"Yes," Susan said.
We lay still.
Susan said,
It's time to jump out of this bed.
Okay. Neither of us moved.
You seem to have succeeded primarily in discovering that you don't know what's going on.
You could say that.
So why are you home?
To show you a good time, I said.
How sweet, she said. Is that the only reason?
Almost, I said. I also have to do some recruiting.
Locally?
Some.
Out of town?
Some.
May I join you?
It would be my pleasure, I said.
I know, Susan said.
She rolled over and put her arms around me and vice versa, and we lay still for a few moments. What about your patients, I said.
It's August, she said. Shrinks are closed in August.
Of course, I said.
But Pearl could be a problem, she said.
Lee Farrell will take care of her, I said.
Will he stay with her at home?
Yes.
Will he try on my clothes while we're gone?
He might. Are we getting up now? I said.
Yes, Susan said. Here I go.
We lay still.
I'm hungry, Susan said.
Me too.
Lucky we're at your house, not mine, she said.
Unless we were dying for a bowl of Cheerios, I said.
I think there's romaine lettuce too, Susan said.
Neither of us moved. Susan rubbed her cheek against my chest. Pearl made a grumbling kind of sigh. She might have been snoring. There were no lights on in the room, and the lavender light had faded to black in the evening sky, so that it was hard to see Susan. I propped myself up a little with the arm I had around her, and turned on the bedside light and looked at her.
"Are you staring at my nude bod?" Susan said.
"I certainly am," I said.
Jewesses, no matter how seductive and comely, do not like to be seen naked in a bright light.
I'll squint, I said. We were quiet for a minute.
How's it looking, she said.
I could tell you better if I weren't squinting.
Well, just to answer my question, open wide.
I studied her for a moment. It appears to be everything a bod should be, I said, including naked. Susan looked a little embarrassed, as if even the word naked discomfited her.
"I'm cold," she said, and yanked the sheet up over herself. "What's for eats?"
"I could make pasta with clam sauce if I use canned clams," I said.
"That sounds nice."
"I could add peas if I use frozen ones."
"I'll get up if you will," she said.
I took in a deep breath and slid my arm out from under her shoulders and swung my legs off the bed and stood up. Susan looked at me with only her eyes and forehead showing above the sheet. Then she giggled and pulled the sheet away and flashed me.
"Something to think about," she said, "while you're cooking."
Chapter 17 I began with Hawk. The Harbor Health Club began as a boxer's gym on the waterfront before the waterfront went upscale. It was owned by Henry Cimoli, who had once been a lightweight fighter. Hawk and I used to work out there a long time ago when we were fighters, before we too went upscale. There had been a ring with spit buckets and heavy bags and speed bags and an assortment of those little Skeeter bags that I had trouble hitting and on which Hawk could play Ravel's Bolero. Now the waterfront was chic, and the Harbor Health Club was even chicer. Henry strolled around in white satin sweats with Henry embroidered in gold above the pocket and asked people if they were having a good workout. The clientele had every imaginable piece of workout gear. Designer sweatbands, wristbands, fingerless leather gloves, brilliant leotards, and the absolute latest in high-tech sneakers. Most of the people who came in were so fashionable that they didn't sweat. All the exercise equipment was gleaming with chrome and flashing lights, ergonomically engineered. But as a nod, perhaps to his youth, and maybe Hawk's and mine, Henry, in a small side room with a window on the harbor, kept one heavy bag, one speed bag, and one Skeeter bag. No ring, no spit buckets. Hawk wasn't in the boxing room. He was doing dips in the main part of the gym. People looked at him covertly. Hawk would notice this. He noticed everything. But he didn't show that he noticed. He never showed anything except maybe a slightly pleasant menace. "I got us a gig out west in the desert," I said.
"That usually means I get no money," Hawk said,
and somebody shoots at me, but I got to travel a long way. He did the dips very strictly, going way down and back up to full extension slowly. The muscles moved ominously under his dark skin. "Not this one," I said. "I have a big budget, and I'm paying handsomely."
"But somebody's still likely to shoot at me," Hawk said.
The dips seemed effortless. His voice showed no strain, but there was a glisten of sweat on his face and arms. "Well, yeah," I said.
"So what we gotta do?"
"Find out who killed a guy, rescue the town from a big gang of mountain trash." Henry Cimoli wandered by. He seemed to be bursting, in a small way, out of his form-fitting white health club suit.
"You guys want to go in the back room?" Henry said. "You're scaring my clients."
"Clients?" I said.
"Gyms have customers," Henry said. "Health clubs have clients."
"Health clubs run by little guys dressed like Liberace," Hawk said, moving his body up and down on the bars.
"I try to maintain a certain image," Henry said.
"You too little to have an image," Hawk said.
"You keep ragging on me," Henry said, "and I'll up your membership fees."
"Henry," I said, "we come here free."
"Well, if the deadly nightshade here don't watch his mouth, it'll be twice that."
"Racial invective," Hawk said.
"Whatever the fuck that is," Henry said.
A middle-aged woman sitting at a chest press machine in pink knit sweats called to Henry. He hustled over.
"Yes, ma'am," he said, all smiles. "How can we help you?"
"Is this too much weight?" the woman said. Henry checked the air pressure dial.
"How many reps can you do with this resistance?" Henry said.
"Oh, I can do a lot, but I don't want to get big and muscly." Henry let his glance slide over at us for a moment.
"The weight is fine, ma'am. Most women don't bulk up. They don't have the biology for it."
"Really?"
Henry nodded thoughtfully. "Yes, ma'am. Testosterone and all that."
"Really?
You can use that weight, maybe even add some."
"Thank you," the woman said, and began pumping the iron. Henry strolled back over to us.
"How much weight she have on there?" Hawk said.
10 pounds, Henry said.
His face remained perfectly blank. Behind us, the woman did 5 reps and stopped and drank from her water bottle and toweled off the machine and moved on.
5 reps, I said, with 10 pounds. You charge her for this?
Does her no harm, Henry said.
The woman seemed to be confused by the lat pull setup, and Henry hustled over to help her.
This gang of mountain trash, Hawk said. How big we talking?
Maybe 30 or 40.
Well, at least be a fair fight, Hawk said. You invite anybody else?
Not yet.
Good to be first, Hawk said.
Chapter 18. Gino Fish did business out of a storefront located in the basement of an old brownstone on Tremont Street in the South End, a couple of blocks from the ballet. The door was down 3 steps and next to a plate glass window on which was written in black letters, "Development Associates of Boston." I went in. The walls were antique brick, unadorned. At a desk, with dark curly hair and wearing an earring, was a very good-looking young man. He was talking on the phone as I came in. Behind him, a maroon velvet curtain separated the back room from the front. I said, "Hello, Stan." When he looked up and saw me, he put his hand over the mouthpiece and spoke to me.
"Spencer, what a treat. You decide to jump the fence at last?"
"If I was going to, I'd jump it with you, cutie. Is Gino in?"
"Gino's almost always in," Stan said. "Vinny's with him."
He nodded me toward the back room and went back to his phone conversation, which had something to do with seeing Tina Turner at the Fleet Center. There were more brick walls in the back room, also unadorned. Gino was in the middle of the room, under a hanging lamp with a Tiffany shade, seated at the round antique table that he used as a desk, reading a brochure from Relay and Chateau worldwide. Vinny was to his left, chair tilted against the wall, listening to his Walkman on his headphones. I said, "Hello, Gino." Gino put a finger into the page he was reading, closed the catalog, and looked slowly up at me. He was bald, slim, and leathery.
"Were you flirting with Stanley?" he said.
"Stanley was flirting with me," I said. "I'm in another program."
Vinny saw me and nodded slightly and kept listening to his earphones.
"And what brings you to me?" Gino said.
"I need to borrow Vinny," I said.
"Really? Where's Hawk?"
"I've recruited him, too."
"For what?"
"I have a job out west that takes 6 or 7 men. I wanted Vinny to be one of them."
"A shooting job, I assume," Gino said.
He had long fingers, which he laced together and rested his chin on. "That's why I want Vinny," I said.
"I didn't imagine you were looking for a dog walker. Have you spoken to Vinny about this?"
"No, I wanted to clear it with you first."
"Very respectful," Gino said. "And, if I may say so, very unlike you."
I grinned. "Vinny wouldn't do it without your say-so anyway," I said. Gino nodded.
"Vinny," he said, "are you listening to this?"
Vinny said,
"Sure."
"If I can spare you," Gino said, "do you have an interest?"
"Pay?" Vinny said.
"Good money," I said.
"I'll listen."
I looked at Gino. Gino nodded. I said, "Let's take a walk." Gino said,
"You don't wish to talk in front of me?"
"True," I said.
"Why?"
"I know Vinny never says anything to anybody about anything, so I trust him. I know that you will do what suits your best interest, so I don't trust you."
"Be careful how you talk to me," Gino said gently.
"You asked," I said. Gino nodded and looked at Vinny and tipped his head toward the door. Vinny got up, and he and I went out. Vinny is shorter than I am and maybe 20 pounds lighter. He's compact and always moved as if he knew exactly what he was doing. Along with a guy in L.A., Vinny was the best shooter I'd ever seen and had the quickest hands. As we walked up Clarendon Street, past Hammersley's Bistro and the new ballet building, Vinny said to me,
"You need to be careful about Gino. Just 'cause he's queer doesn't mean he's not tough."
"I know he's tough," I said.
"Gino's okay," Vinny said.
"Sure," I said. I told him about Potshot and the Dell and the Preacher. Vinny didn't interrupt. When I was through, he said,
"Who else is in it?"
"Hawk," I said.
"And you?"
"Yeah."
"I come in, that's 3.
"Uh-huh."
"Who else you going for?"
"People you don't know."
"Out of town?"
Vinny said. It wasn't a question. He would know anybody in town. "Yes," I said. "You in?"
"Sure,"
Vinny said. Chapter 19. Susan and I were in Atlanta, in Buckhead, at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Susan was on the phone with the concierge. When she hung up, she said, "We have a reservation at the Horseradish Grill at 7. "Are you planning to have a green salad and a small iced tea?" I said.
"Maybe we could split one," she said.
"I don't know if I should eat that much," I said. "I've got a big day tomorrow."
"How far a drive is it to Lamar?"
"Couple of hours," I said, "east on Route 20.
"Maybe I'll come with you," she said.
"I thought you wanted to shop Buckhead."
"I think I'd like to go with you."
"On Rodeo Drive," I said, "on 5th Avenue and Worth Avenue and North Michigan Avenue, shoppers genuflect at the mere mention of Buckhead. And you, for whom shopping is one of the 7 lively arts, you want to take a 2-hour drive with me to Lamar, Georgia?"
"Yes."
"Is it because you are hoping to score me in the back seat of the rental car on the way down?"
"No."
"Well, it was a good guess," I said.
"I want to go," she said, "because in a little while I won't have much chance to be with you until you come back from the desert. It's why I wanted to come this far with you."
"Because you love me madly?" I said.
"I think so. Or it might be pity."
I picked her up in my arms and held her there.
"It's love," I said. "Yes," she said, and kissed me.
We ate fried chicken and mashed potatoes at the Horseradish Grill, where Susan flirted with gluttony. After dinner, we drove back along Powers Ferry Road in the blue evening, as it coiled languidly through a landscape of low hills, high trees, and big homes, many of them with white pillars. Susan had her head back against the seat with her eyes closed, with the moonlight on her face.
"Post-gluttonous languor," I said. "More like contentment," she said. I've eaten well, I've had some wine. I'm driving through a soft night toward a fine hotel with my honey bun. Whom you plan to bang like a drum once we get there? Whom I plan to snuggle until we fall asleep and the after effects of dining excess fade.
There's always tomorrow, I said.
She rolled her head toward me, and I could see her smile.
And we're both early risers, she said.
I grinned. So to speak, I said. She smiled and kept her eyes closed and didn't say anything for a while.
Are we going to see that gay man you met when you were down here about the horse business?
Teddy Sapp, I said. Gay man doesn't quite cover him.
I know, Susan said. It never quite covers anyone.
She was quiet. The road turned. The moonlight shifted so that it slanted in behind her profile. In the pale shine of it, motionless, with her eyes closed, she looked like something carved out of alabaster. Looking at her, I felt my throat tighten. I could hear my breathing. Leaving her to go off and rescue Potshot seemed unthinkable. I took in some air, slowly, through my nostrils, and let it out even more slowly.
"We're both wishing you didn't have to go back to Potshot," Susan said.
Susan's eyes were still closed, her profile still ivory. The quiet of the Georgian night muffled the sound of the car. After a while, I said, "We're wishing we could spend all our time together like this forever, I guess." She nodded without opening her eyes.
"If we got what we wished for," she said, "it would destroy us."
"Nothing would destroy us," I said.
"No, you're right. Nothing would," she said.
"But if we were together all the time, it would make moments like this impossible."
"A variation on Sunday morning," I said. "Not the CBS thing."
"No, the Stevens poem. Death is the mother of beauty."
"Supply and demand," Susan said. "If everyone lived forever, life would devalue."
"I think so," I said.
"And if we were together all the time, the specialness might wane."
"Or maybe it's all an abstract poetical conceit," I said.
"Maybe," Susan said. "Either way, we do what we do."
"And," I said, "the sun'll come up this morning."
"You and the sun both," she said, and smiled to herself as if she were very pleased at her small joke.
Chapter 20. The sun had, in fact, risen this morning, and we were a little late getting started to Lamar. When we got there, it was nearly lunchtime. The bathhouse bar and grill still had a neon Spuds McKenzie looking raffish in the window. Inside was darker and cooler. The old-fashioned jukebox was the same, and the bar across the back was as it had been, with wine selections and lunch specials listed on a chalkboard. The dance floor to the right of the front door was empty, and there were only a couple of guys at the bar, getting an early start. Teddy Sapp was drinking coffee at his table to the left. His blonde hair was still brightly artificial. He had a new earring, but he was still wearing the bathhouse employee costume, green polo shirt and chinos. Unlike the bartender and the two waiters who were setting up for lunch, Teddy filled the green polo shirt to fabric stretching capacity. The muscles were so prominent, and the body so hard, and the gaze so flat, that if I weren't so tough, Teddy Sapp might have scared me. Fortunately, I was with Susan.
"Goodness gracious," Teddy said when he saw me. "Y'all came back."
His voice had a gentle hoarseness, which, as he talked, you soon forgot. "Hello, Teddy. This is Susan Silverman."
"The shrink?"
Sapp said.
"Yes," Susan said.
"And main squeeze," Teddy said.
"And only squeeze," Susan said, and put out her hand and smiled. Teddy didn't appear to scare her. Teddy smiled back and stood and put out his hand and shook hers. Susan didn't appear to scare him. He gestured us to sit.
"Coffee, beer, late breakfast?"
"Coffee," I said.
"Could I get some hot water and lemon?"
Sapp grinned and didn't comment. He gestured one of the waiters over.
"Two coffees," he said, "and a pot of hot water and some lemon."
The waiter nodded and started away.
"And could I have some of those fake sugar thingies?" Susan said.
The waiter paused.
"We'll have equal, ma'am."
"That'd be great," Susan said.
"High maintenance," Teddy said.
And well goddamn worth it, Susan said.
You think?
Sapp said to me. I nodded vigorously. How's the ophthalmologist? I said.
High maintenance, Teddy said.
He smiled.
And well goddamned worth it, he said.